I am Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this is American History. Reading today from presidential historian Michael Beschloss's Presidents of War. We finished his essay on Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the run-up to World War II. Now we begin his essay on Franklin Delano Roosevelt after America's entry into the war. Michael Beschloss's essay is called The Survival War. Now, as the nation embarked on its most perilous war, Franklin Roosevelt was resolved, unlike Woodrow Wilson in 1917, should constantly explain the issues at stake, his strategy, and how the conflict was unfolding. Although Pearl Harbor had united most of the country behind the war, the enemy was on the offensive in the Pacific. For the first time since the War of 1812, the United States was facing an extended period of defeat by a foreign military force. Roosevelt was worried about the damage of these setbacks to national morale. During this war, unlike every previous president waging a major conflict, Roosevelt could rely on radio to broadcast his statements to a vast audience. Americans were lucky to have a commander-in-chief who was not a neophyte. As Assistant Secretary of the Navy, Roosevelt had scrutinized both Woodrow Wilson's accomplishments and his blunders. He had heard the private running commentary of Cousin Theodore Roosevelt, who had filled his ears about what Wilson was doing wrong in World War I. Theodore Roosevelt had harped on Wilson's wartime failure to reach out to Congress, especially to the opposing party. On Tuesday, January 6, 1942, the coldest day thus far that winter, amid a vicious wind, the somber president arrived at the Capitol to deliver his State of the Union message. Normally, Roosevelt wore a gray frocked coat for the occasion. This time, he was dressed in black. At 12:32 in the afternoon, on the arm of his aide, General Edwin Paw Watson, he slowly entered the House chamber, using his steel-braced legs, as members leapt to their feet for a full minute of applause. Speaking more slowly than usual, Roosevelt told Congress that Japan's scheme of conquest goes back half a century. That plan was to subjugate all the peoples in the Far East and dominate the Pacific by controlling the western coasts of North, Central, and South America. But Japan's dreams, Roosevelt said, were modest compared with the gigantuan aspirations of Hitler and his Nazis to dominate the whole earth. The Nazis sought a new worldwide pagan religion under which the Holy Bible and the Cross of Mercy would be displaced by Mein Kampf and the swastika and the naked sword. Now, Roosevelt said, Hitler and his Italian and Japanese chessmen would face superior forces that would strike at the common enemy. Roosevelt noted that 26 nations stood against the Axis powers. To a resounding ovation, he vowed, the militarists of Berlin and Tokyo started this war, but the massed, angered forces of common humanity will finish it. Every available plant and tool, he said, must be converted to war production. The nation required 60,000 new planes and 45,000 new tanks in the next year, as well as 125,000 planes and 75,000 tanks the year after that. The same was true of ships, anti-aircraft guns, and other implements of war. Attracting the loudest response, Roosevelt said he hoped his statistics will give the Japanese and the Nazis a little idea of just what they accomplished in the attack at Pearl Harbor. Building this arsenal would require spending more than half the nation's income, as well as higher taxes, and cutting luxuries and other non-essentials, according to Roosevelt. Leveling with Americans, the president went on, we have already tasted defeat. We may suffer further setbacks. We must face the fact of a hard war, a long war, a bloody war, a costly war. The alternative, he said, was a world of tyranny and cruelty and serfdom. Afterwards, Speaker of the House Sam Rayburn proclaimed, of all his great speeches, this is the greatest. Wendell Willkie called the address magnificent, but warned that the proposed plan could not be achieved by Roosevelt's present organization and administrative methods. That same week, Americans told Gallup poll that they approved of the president's job performance by 84% to 9%. In late February, before Roosevelt gave a fireside chat on radio, his press secretary, Stephen Early, asked Americans to consult globes or world maps while the president described the course of the war. Maps were published in newspapers, and stores sold out of their globes. The president told his listeners, "Your government has unmistakable confidence in your ability to hear the worst without flinching or losing heart." He pledged to keep nothing from you except information that will help the enemy in his attempt to destroy us. And he asked Americans to pay little attention to the rumor mongers and the poison peddlers in our midst. The struggle they were entering was different from all other wars of the past, he said. Victory would require warfare in terms of every continent, every island, every sea, every air lane in the world. That spring, Roosevelt tried to devise a name for the new conflict. He feared that calling it the Second World War might link the struggle too closely to Wilson's venture in 1918, from which so many Americans still cringed. Thus, while speaking at the Pan American Union, Roosevelt proposed the Survival War. That is what it came pretty close to being, the survival of our civilization, he said. During the early months of this war, Roosevelt committed a tragic offense against civil liberties, the forced removal of Japanese Americans. At that time, to be sure, no one knew where Japan might strike next. During a Western trip the week after Pearl Harbor, Eleanor Roosevelt, his wife, wrote Lorena Hickok that, "We had an anxious trip out, fearing the West Coast was being bombed." Within 2 days of the assault on Hawaii, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, consulting its suspect enemy aliens list, arrested more than 1,200 Japanese-born U.S. residents, most on the West Coast and in Hawaii, as well as 620 Germans and 98 Italians who were not citizens. But unlike American residents born in Germany and Italy, many of Japanese ancestry suffered from a special problem. The race-conscious Immigration Act of 1924 would not allow them to become U.S. citizens. And unlike the huge populations of German and Italian heritage in the country, little more than 100,000 people came from Japan, and they were easily isolated, except for a few thousand all resided west of the Rocky Mountains. Before Christmas 1941, although the news was censored, the oil tanker Montebello had been sunk by a Japanese submarine off the California coast, and so had two freighters. Amid widespread anxiety that Japan would invade the west coast of America, California's Attorney General Earl Warren warned that the Japanese situation in his state may well be the Achilles heel of the entire civil defense effort, threatening a repetition of Pearl Harbor. After dining with Earl Warren in California, the influential columnist Walter Lippmann, who had advised Woodrow Wilson during the 1919 Paris conference after World War I, warned of a fifth column on the West Coast. The conservative columnist Westbrook Pegler called for U.S. citizens of Japanese descent to be placed under armed guard and to hell with habeas corpus until the danger was over. Fletcher Bowron, the Los Angeles mayor, fired city workers of Japanese origin, claiming that Abraham Lincoln, the mild-mannered man whose memory we regard with almost saint-like reverence, would make short work of rounding up the Japanese. "We have to be tough," insisted the San Francisco Chronicle, "even if civil rights do take a beating for a time." Congressman John Rankin of Mississippi said, "This is a race war demanding to get rid of every Japanese, whether in Hawaii or on the mainland. Damn them all." In San Francisco, Lieutenant General John DeWitt, commander of the 4th Army, reported by telephone to Assistant Secretary of War John McCloy, "Out here, a Jap is a Jap to these people now." McCloy replied that if the safety of the country was in question, why, the Constitution is just a scrap of paper to me. J. Edgar Hoover, director of the FBI, argued that the West Coast had no Japanese problem and warned Attorney General Biddle against public hysteria. Hoover wrote Attorney General Biddle, that demands for mass removal of citizens of Japanese heritage were based primarily upon public and political pressure rather than on factual data. Secretary of War Henry Stimson complained into his diary that J. Edgar Hoover did not understand the great potential danger of the Japanese because he could not gain access to their secret thoughts. Attorney General Biddle, known as a friend of civil liberties, declined to say that removing U.S. citizens from their homes would be unconstitutional. He was only 5 months in office and bashful about standing up to the military. But Biddle told the president that there was no reason for mass evacuation. He also warned that some Americans on the West Coast would welcome the removal of Japanese citizens from good farmland and the elimination of their competition. Eleanor Roosevelt implored her husband to forestall the removals so insistently that he asked her to stop raising the subject with him. Secretary of War Stimson appealed for a meeting with Roosevelt on what he called the West Coast matter, but was told that the president had larger problems to deal with. Instead, on February 11th, the two men spoke by telephone. As Stimson recorded, he fortunately found Roosevelt very vigorous about the issue, and the president told him to go ahead on the line that he thought the best. The next day, Attorney General Biddle told Stimson he had no doubt the mass removal would be legal if deemed essential from a military point of view. At Stimson's behest, McCloy wrote to DeWitt, quote, "We have carte blanche to do what we want to as far as the president is concerned. He states there will probably be some repercussions, but it's got to be dictated by military necessity. But as he puts it, be as reasonable as you can." On February 19th, with Attorney General Biddle at his side, President Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066, drafted by Secretary of War Stimson and General McCloy, using legalistic language. It authorized Stimson to prescribe the military areas and decide which any or all persons may be excluded from them. The word Japanese was nowhere mentioned. Eleanor Roosevelt was shocked by her husband's decision. Just before Pearl Harbor, she had assured Americans by radio that no law-abiding aliens of any nationality would be discriminated against by the government. When the president opted to exile the Japanese Americans, she was caught by surprise and appalled. Her biographer, Blanche Wason Cook, wrote that the internment decision marked a turning point in their relationship, after which the First Lady staked out more emotional distance from her husband. In public, however, she loyally explained that the Japanese Americans were being removed both for their own safety and for the safety of the country. Forced to defend the order, Attorney General Biddle assured the press that habeas corpus would not be suspended in the affected regions, nor would there be martial law. Asked to suggest a precedent for this, the Attorney General lamely recalled that during World War I, President Wilson had directed that nobody could move in the air without a permit. But Biddle conceded that never before had the United States created a plan that might lead to this kind of mass evacuation. He claimed, "The move has been taken largely for the protection of the Japanese themselves." The Baltimore Sun newspaper wrote that there must be advance safeguards against the treachery of some Japanese Americans who may use the privileges of citizenship against our republic. The following month, Japanese American citizens and aliens told to take only what you can carry started being moved by train and bus to makeshift assembly centers. That June, American won the Battle of Midway, reducing the chance that Japanese ships could attack the West Coast in large numbers. Although the chief rationale for the internment of Japanese Americans was fading, more than 100,000 evacuees were taken to barracks in 10 newly built camps in California, Arizona, Wyoming, Utah, Idaho, Colorado, and Arkansas, with eight-person families confined to single rooms. Don Elberson, a conscientious objector assigned to meet some of the internees trains, recalled, "It was too terrible to witness the pain in people's faces, too shameful for them to be seen in this degrading situation." After retiring as Chief Justice of the United States, Earl Warren, who was governor of California, was asked in 1971 by an oral history interviewer about the evacuation, and he wept in mortification. It was not until the 1980s that the U.S. government confessed that the program had been an abomination, mocking its wartime contention that it was on the correct moral side of a war against racism and disrespect for personal liberties. Claiming that he had been just a leg man for Secretary of War Stimson, who had died in 1950, McCloy, at age 86, testified before a congressional commission on the subject that the internment had been reasonably undertaken and thoughtfully and humanely conducted. When McCloy added that war had caused disruption in our lives, the audience scoffed and booed, as they should have. In 1988, President Ronald Reagan signed a bill that provided a formal apology and payments of $20,000 to survivors of the internment camps. The pugnacious and unrepentant McCloy told a friend that the hearings had been a disgrace and derided the idea of restitution. "Money, money, money," McCloy exclaimed. "Why don't they done the Japanese government? We didn't attack Pearl Harbor. The Japanese did." Eleanor Roosevelt was deeply unsettled by the possibility that at least one of their four sons would be killed in the war. Franklin Jr. and John had joined the Navy. Elliot joined a bomber squadron, and Jimmy was a Marine. She wrote in a newspaper column, My Day, that the exact whereabouts of three of her boys were wrapped in mystery. On his Oval Office desk, President Roosevelt kept little hand-colored photographs in a single frame of their sons in uniform. By the spring of 1942, some Americans were complaining about Roosevelt's policy of Atlantic First, which he had reaffirmed during Winston Churchill's Christmas visit to the White House. Roosevelt told General George Marshall that crushing Japan would not vanquish Germany, but defeat of Germany means the defeat of Japan, probably without firing a shot or losing a life. The president's critics argued that even though American intervention had been provoked by an attack in the Pacific, Roosevelt was so absorbed by the British and Soviet plight that he was neglecting U.S. forces waging the Battle of Bataan in the Philippines under General Douglas MacArthur. "Send ships to aid MacArthur now," demanded the New York Journal-American newspaper, a Hearst tabloid, calling the Pacific commander the greatest fighting general America has produced since the Civil War. But when the Gallup poll asked who was the chief enemy in the war, Americans said Germany over Japan by 50-25%. Congresswoman Mary Norton, a Democrat from New Jersey, advised the president to make more frequent use of radio to defend himself. Roosevelt replied, "From now on, for the duration of the war, there are going to be periods of hysteria, misinformation, volcanic eruptions, etc. And if I start the practice of going on the air to answer each one, the value of my going on the air will soon disappear. For the sake of not becoming a platitude to the public, I ought not to appear oftener than once every 5 or 6 weeks. I am inclined to think that in England, Winston Churchill, for a while, talked too much, and I don't want to do that." Roosevelt had many allies on Capitol Hill, some of long standing, and he kept in close jocular contact with them. For instance, Senator Carter Glass of Virginia complained to Roosevelt by letter of a federal effort to acquire 25 acres next to Arlington National Cemetery, which would deprive his home county of tax income. With dark humor, Roosevelt replied that government purchase of the land will bring a lot more people into Arlington County at once, although if it is used as a cemetery, the latter occupants will contribute only headstones. The president knew how to fend off congressional challenges. 3 weeks after Pearl Harbor, Senator Arthur Vandenberg, Republican from Michigan, a pre-war isolationist, had proposed a freewheeling House and Senate committee on the conduct of the war, resembling that of Civil War times, which had so nettled Abraham Lincoln. Roosevelt did not publicly denounce the premise of such a panel, as Woodrow Wilson had before World War I. Instead, he slathered on the syrup, writing Vandenberg that he would be delighted to cooperate, noting that, since war came to us, Congress had given great comfort to all who believed in our political system. But out of public view, the president maneuvered to ensure that there would be no broad-gauged watchdog committee. Roosevelt's friend, Justice Frankfurter of the Supreme Court, counseled him to create an apparatus to ensure centralized execution of the president's will during the war. Emulating Woodrow Wilson, Roosevelt established a War Production Board, chaired by ex-Sears Roebuck chief Donald Nelson. Alf Landon complained that the president was leading the country to totalitarian collectivism, treating the war as just another political alphabetical project. But Herbert Hoover, even though he had been Roosevelt's harsh political foe since their showdown in the 1932 election, told a New York audience that to win total war, the chief executive must be granted some dictatorial powers, although he warned that the likely result would be just plain fascist economics. After more than a decade of the Great Depression, Roosevelt now had to deal with inflation, brought on by a surging war economy. He warned Congress that our standard of living will have to come down, and contended that no American should enjoy an after-tax income of $25,000 per year. The White Shoe Republican New York Herald Tribune newspaper called this argument a blatant piece of demagoguery. The president believed that when financing his war, Woodrow Wilson had accepted too much borrowing, which had fueled inflation. This time, Roosevelt sought higher taxes, including an excess profits tax that would prevent defense profiteering and large new taxes for the wealthy, as well as wage and price controls. But throughout the summer of 1942, the Democratic House and Senate resisted the president's demand. On Labor Day Monday, September 7, 1942, Roosevelt wrote to Congress that if it did not act before October, he would move on his own, motivated by an inescapable responsibility to ensure that the war effort is no longer imperiled by threat of economic chaos, which makes the use of executive power far more essential than in any previous war. In Abraham Lincoln's spirit, Roosevelt added, when the war is won, the powers under which I act automatically revert to the people to whom they belong. That evening at Hyde Park, New York, Roosevelt explained his ultimatum during a fireside chat, delivered from his pale green office in his new Fieldstone library built on the family estate. Sitting underneath a naval painting and next to a portrait of his mother, Roosevelt told radio listeners, "Wars are not won by people who are concerned primarily with their own comfort and their own pocketbooks. We need not leave it to historians of the future to answer the question whether we are tough enough to meet this unprecedented challenge. The answer is yes." The Wisconsin Senator Robert La Follette Jr., son of Wilson's old foe, carped that Roosevelt had placed a pistol at the head of Congress. Senator Robert Taft of Ohio called the president's defiant talk so revolutionary and so dangerous that he cannot permit it to go unchallenged. But unwilling to be viewed as an impediment to the war effort, the Democratic House and Senate gave Roosevelt most of what he wanted, including a peak wartime income tax rate of 88%. That fall, under supervision by the President and Colonel Leslie Groves of the Army Corps of Engineers, the Philadelphia contractor John McShane was constructing a vast new home for the Department of War, which, when completed, would be the world's largest office building. Moving from what had been called the State War and Navy Building in Washington, immediately west of the White House, Secretary of War Stimson and his top echelon had camped out in the Munitions Building, a temporary structure built during the Great War of 1918, next to what was now the Lincoln Memorial's reflecting pool. This and sister office buildings jammed onto the site had been built under Assistant Secretary of the Navy Franklin Roosevelt, serving under Woodrow Wilson, who at first had recommended a hideous wood design so that officials would demand their swift demolition after the Great War, World War I. When a new War Department headquarters was built on C Street in Foggy Bottom in Washington, it was immediately found to be too small for that epoch of rearmament and impending world war. Thus, the president had approved hasty construction of the immense Pentagon across the Potomac River, its shape resembling U.S. forts of old, such as Fort McHenry and Sumter. Built on a 16-month rush schedule, the poured concrete structure was intended to use a minimum of steel in order to save the material for national defense. Ramps were substituted for steel elevators. When Roosevelt toured the building in May 1942, he asked why there were so many washrooms, and he was told that Virginia law required segregated facilities. The new Pentagon was a symbol of the fact that when this war was done, the United States would have to maintain a large defense establishment. With the early American aversion to a large standing army dispelled, such a development would strengthen the presidency of the future. Roosevelt authorized Colonel Groves and the Army Corps to proceed with the secret Manhattan Project, which was rushing to perfect an atomic weapon. If this effort succeeded, outpacing a rival secret enterprise by the Germans, it would ensure an Allied victory and establish the United States as the post-war world's overwhelming military power. An atomic bomb, with its potential to kill millions of human beings, would endow future presidents of the United States with extraordinary new authority. Reading from Michael Beschloss's essay on Franklin Roosevelt and World War II, entitled "The Survival War Will Be Continued." This is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left-click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then under Programming Links, left-click on On Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.